This is Joel Kotkin.
And this is Marshall Toplansky.
And you're listening to the Feudal Future podcast. Our society is being rapidly reduced to a feudal state, a process now being exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Millions of small businesses are near extinction. Millions more are losing their jobs, and many others will be stuck in the status of propertyless serfs. The big winners have been the expert class of the clerisy, and most of all, the tech oligarchs, who benefit as people rely more on algorithms than human relationships.
With this, around the world, the middle class is becoming more squeezed than ever, and it's having profound economic, social, and spiritual implications. Here on the show, we're having conversations with business, government, and citizen leaders like you to get to the core of these issues and explore how we can work together to form a better future than the one we're headed towards. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Feudal Future podcast. I'm Marshall Toplansky.
I'm Joel Kotkin.
And we are delighted today to have three guests with us. The first guest is Charles Blaine, who's the president of the Urban Reform Institute, which he launched in 2019 in partnership with the Center for Opportunity Urbanism in Houston. Charles has been published in the Wall Street Journal, City Journal, and Forbes, and he is the host of a regular political talk show on Sunday mornings on Fox 26 in Houston called What's Your Point? Brian Kaye is CEO of The Village Voice and LA Weekly. He is formerly editorial director of the Southern California News Group, which includes LA Daily News, Orange County Register, and Long Beach Press-Telegram. And of course, he is a distinguished fellow faculty member, professor of communication at Chapman University. And finally, Cullum Clark is director of the George W. Bush Institute's SMU Economic Growth Initiative. And he's adjunct professor of economics at SMU. Within the Economic Growth Initiative, he heads the Bush Institute's work on domestic economic policy and economic growth. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start it off by talking about a highly timely topic, the state of the Republican Party. Joel has a thesis about this. Joel, yeah. why don't you tell us what you think the Republican Party is going to be turning into?
Well, I follow politics in Europe quite a bit. My wife's family's from France, so France is a particular interest. And in France, what seems to have happened is the right so much, or the conservatives, however you want to put it, have become coalesced under the National Front Marine Le Pen's party. And they're a permanent 35% of the vote. And they don't seem to be able to ever get closer. And whether or not that's what the Republican Party, given that it retains its Trumpista form, that it will be just a permanent minority party. It'll be a majority in some states, but will become irrelevant nationally. So that's sort of my provocative thesis to throw out to you guys.
What do you think? Cullum, you want to start us off?
Sure. I think Joel's onto something. So my day job is not so much partisan politics, but, economics and policy. So let me make throw out an idea that I think is consistent with Joel's. I think history teaches, Marshall, that for a political party to be successful over the long term, it has to have basically a policy program. It doesn't actually have to have a policy program that is, on the whole, all that great in terms of like how useful is it for the country, but at least has to have a policy program that is reasonably coherent, understood by people in general, and is at least good for somebody, right? Like there's some reasonable collection of forces that would actually think it's good for us if that program gets implemented. I think the Republican Party is in danger of going down a path where it has essentially no policy program, or what little there is not in anybody's interest. To me, almost every avenue that it's looking at is unhelpful in that regard. We talked earlier about the idea of setting up the circular firing squad. I think that's very much the case on the policy front. where we're in danger of the party. There's maybe one wing that would say the answer is in some sense autarky, closing off from the outside world. There'd be another piece that would say it's about being more anti-business and anti-markets than the competition, than their opponents. Another voice would say we'll try to somehow compete with the Democrats for being redistributionist. And I think what is kind of common to all of those is they're all a departure from the Republican Party's kind of traditional identity as the party of growth and opportunity. I mean, the Democrats actually, you know, kind of have always been the party of help poor people and address historical social injustices. So the Republicans are throwing out their old brand and have absolutely no idea what the new brand would be in terms of policy. So I think in the lack of a more coherent policy program, if it's only a party of kind of sort of resentment, then I think Joel is absolutely right.
Excellent insight. Charles, I feel like you're usually the talk show host in your real life, and I'm kind of usurping that role. But can you jump in and tell us what you think?
No, and I kind of want to echo what Cullum's saying, because I think he makes a really, really valid point about not having any sort of unifying policy or even really principles nowadays that everybody can rally around in the party. And I think that was really evident if you look back at the RNC convention when they met to come up with the platform. They said, well, we're just going to adopt the previous platform. We're not going to talk about issues and put together a new platform. We're just going to pull what we had and pull what the president's running on, and that's going to be our platform. And so rather than creating a platform that then they hold their elected officials, their Republican elected officials accountable to and, you know, test them by and make sure that when the next primary comes, if they didn't adhere to the principles and the policies you said, you run someone against them and all the things that the Republican Party usually says they want to do in terms of holding their elected officials accountable, they said, we're just going to adopt whatever the elected officials are doing. And it kind of went the other, so it reversed the situation where the citizens were no longer the ones in charge. It was, well, the elected officials are going to guide us. And it kind of just built this cult around the president. And I think that now that he's gone, there's no policies to rally around. And so it's kind of like they're just lost in the wilderness looking for the next, I guess, person to follow, but that's not going to emerge anytime soon. And especially with such a fractured party, where you can't even rally around one type of person, I think that's going to make it even harder going forward. So, I mean, there's a long way to go, and I don't know where the rebuilding starts, but it needs to start soon.
Right. Well, and we're kind of in the mode of rebuilding through chopping off their heads, which is why I put my French Revolution background up. It seems like accountability is being forced in that manner. Brian, what do you think? What's your read?
You know, I guess I would liken things to California, where, you know, I've spent most of my life, and where the Republican Party has essentially become a regional party. And, you know, there's no real viability, or hasn't been any real viability, for a candidate to win statewide office for some time. I mean, I think the most viable candidate that did do that was Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he had to get in through a recall. And we might have another recall here pretty soon. So maybe that's their opportunity. But for the most part, the Republican Party in California has been relegated to third party status. And I think that was because in some ways they were the Trump Party before the Trump Party took over the Republican Party in recent years on the national level. And I think that's because, you know, when I was a kid, I think in 92 or 94, I was in middle school, when Prop 187 was on the ballot, the Republicans made that their biggest issue. And that, for people who don't know or don't follow California politics, was the proposition that was later that passed, but was later overturned, that took away any kind of government services, including schooling, for anyone who was undocumented or in the country, quote unquote, illegally. And it was a big priority for Republicans. Pete Wilson ran on it. It passed, but like I said, it was overturned. But ever since that day, the Republican Party kind of marked themselves as the party of Prop 187 in California. And they lost the largest growing demographic in the state of California, which was the Latino vote. And, you know, I think that based on the priorities of the Trump administration and the turn of the national party, they're risking similar. Now, you know, to correct myself a little bit, Trump did and Republicans did better with Hispanics in this particular election than they thought they would do. But even still, the similarities, I think, between California's shift, the California Republican Party's shift in the 90s and the National Republican Party shift during the Trump era, which I don't think is over, by the way, which we can get into, is eerily similar. And I think that, to Joel's point, it really does make you a marginalized party that doesn't really have any influence in governance.
Just for, just by the way, for the sake of education for people who may not know what Prop 187 was, just take a second and tell people what that was.
Yeah, no, I mentioned it a second ago. It was the proposition that basically would take away any kind of government services from anyone who is undocumented or in the state illegally. And I think one of the, I remember that for me, because I'm half Latino, and I went to a even then majority Latino school district, and I walked out as a 11-year-old from school. That one of the things was that if you couldn't get access to education, and it didn't go over well, as you can imagine, in Latino communities.
Yeah. But the point that you're making, though, is that we're entering, or we're in, such a multicultural world, especially in the United States as a whole, not just in California, that it's hard to imagine a party that doesn't recognize that, that kind of plays on traditional distrust of different groups, really ever becoming a majority party.
Yeah, I just like to, you know, I know Charles told me that there were some, just to say that, you know, Republican stupidity is not just confined to California, that there were several county chairmen in Texas who made pretty openly racist remarks, which, you know, then had to be, you know, reined in. Do you think that's illustrative, Charles, of a large part of the Republican Party today?
You know, it's interesting because up until that point, and even when it was happening, I would have said no. And actually, I did a couple of interviews with some local papers as it was happening where I said it wasn't. But then to see the defense of these chairmen and of their remarks by folks who were just in the party, who weren't, you know, part of the party structure or apparatus, but were just activists or citizens who were then defending them, kind of changed my perspective a bit. But yeah, I mean, I think we had, over the course of probably 2 weeks, I think there were 12 chairmen across the state, the biggest of them being the largest county here, Harris County, chairman, who came out and had, you know, derogatory or outright racist remarks or memes that they had posted on their Facebook, and the media started finding them. And then after a while, it became a witch hunt to try to find all of them, which I don't mind. I mean, they did that, so it should be found out. But to see it all happen initially, it blew up and there was outrage, and our statewide elected officials knew it was bad. The governor came out against it, the lieutenant governor, I think both senators, if I'm not mistaken, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, a number of congressmen came out. But then at around, you know, the 2 week mark, something switched and a lot of local folks started saying, well, they're just trying to throw them under the bus to save themselves. What they said wasn't that bad. You know, we need to stop this cancel culture. We need to push back against this. But, you know, and that's what frustrates me. It's kind of like they want to identify it as cancel culture, but that's not cancel culture. When you do something bad and then you have to deal with the repercussions of that, that's not cancel culture. Cancel culture is something entirely different. But the way that they associated that with cancel culture showed me that there is a large portion of the party that does think and feel that way. And it's an educational effort to change that, but also an educational effort to elevate the voices that don't think that way. Unfortunately, the ones that do often have the microphone, and they're a very loud contingent of them who think that way.
Cullum, does that resonate with you? I mean, you're in Texas as well.
Yeah, I think, Joel, you know me well. I think of myself as a pretty glass half full sort of person, so I'll give sort of an optimistic take on it. I think not inconsistent with what Charles said. I pretty strongly believe that in, you know, going forward in electoral terms, that racism is a giant vote loser, and a message of growth, opportunity, and prosperity is a vote winner. But I do think there's a kind of a math problem, and the math problem, and I like math too. The math problem is that we may be in a period of time when you can have a large but still minority share of a minority party that is subscribing to some pretty noxious views. But that minority of a minority, let's say it's one third of one third, like, you know, one third of people being self-identified Republicans, may actually be able to, in a sense, come across as the, you know, sort of the view of the Republican Party for a time, in effect, influence the brand, possibly even win primary elections if the other two thirds are not, in a sense, don't have the discipline to kind of organize themselves around a better message. And so then you can have a situation where one third of one third dictates the, you know, kind of the ethos, maybe not the specific policies, but the kind of whole, you know, mode of communication of one of the two major parties, therefore condemning it to being a small rump party for years to come. That might happen. But I do think it's a, like I said, a minority of a minority that espouses such obnoxious and repellent views.
Yeah, but the problem with that argument and the problem numerically is that, to your earlier point, you know, it's the winners ultimately, the sustainable winners have policies that attract enough of the majority to be able to actually affect change or create growth. And you need some form of, if not overall consensus, at least enough of a consensus to be able to make it happen. And what I see happening is that the minorities of minorities are armed. They're more vociferous than they've ever been. They're more violent than they've ever been. And, you know, what does that really mean for stability for the rest of the country?
Well, I obviously it's pretty scary. Now, I will say, you know, the armed and violent piece is, thank goodness, so far a relatively small piece. And crucially, it doesn't involve any actual like apparatus of state power, federal, state or local, actually taking some kind of, you know, taking the side of, you know, something that is, you know, kind of a force for kind of disorder and chaos. You know, for the time being, actually, the institutions that have the legitimate monopoly on the use of force have pretty much held together, and we need to keep it that way. But I do think, in a larger sense, coming back to my policy point, Marshall, we're on a bad path as a country if we don't have both major political parties in some sense being like a relative, you know, the best version of themselves, or at least a reasonably good version of themselves. So there needs to be a party of, I know I keep saying this, there needs to be a party of growth, opportunity, you know, economic betterment, just as there needs to be a party for redressing past injustices and helping poor people and, modernizing the safety net. Right now, we only have one of those two things. And that way lies, probably a really bad path forward on the public policy front until the game is competitive again.
I'd just like to maybe, Brian, if you could address this. I mean, because we'll start with California. I just read then that there's now talk that Facebook will not run any ads from the recall campaign against Governor Newsom. Are we running into an era where within the next 2, 3, 4 years, even relatively mainstream Republican voices will find themselves essentially marginalized to the point that they will no longer be able to communicate with people, particularly on social media?
Well, first off, I don't want to give credence to that particular story, because I would want to read it, investigate it. And I hadn't read that anywhere. I did read that Facebook was going to limit political content or start taking steps to limit political news, which I think is very interesting and also terrible for a variety of reasons. But I think that, you know, one of the things that is getting little attention, particularly from mainstream media, but obviously so, is that even in situations where the news was critical of left-leaning or Democratic candidates, say Biden, that some of that news was suppressed, even in situations where it was accurate. And there aren't a whole lot of examples that at least make national news or headlines on the other foot, right? So there wasn't a whole lot of, okay, these things are lies or being said about whatever Republican. And so I think we're getting into a really dangerous situation where big tech, regardless if you're left or right, and I'm probably right in the center, but we're getting into a situation where these technology companies have in 2020 completely flexed their muscle in terms of what they can do in elections. And the good news is that both policymakers at the federal and state levels have recognized this on both sides of the aisle. So I think that there is at least some bipartisan consensus that something needs to be done to regulate big tech and their ability to control information. There's also some people, even in the media space, I read a piece yesterday in the Washington Post, where it's like, well, the government shouldn't necessarily be the arbiter of that. Maybe we should leave it to big tech, which I think is, which is really troubling. And if you think about it, you know, outside of the national political discussion, which is obviously heavily divisive, everyone talked about kind of things that Twitter did or things that Facebook did or whatever, Google. But one of the really interesting things that people haven't really dived deeply into was what Uber did in California, which was not only did they spend, and not only did Silicon Valley spend a bunch of money to support a proposition that essentially got rid of AB5, or at least AB5, which was the law that affected gig workers and made them employees as opposed to independent contractors. But not only did they spend money like anyone would to influence the political process, they also used their technology apparatuses. So every time you opened an Uber app to take a ride, which I did several times right before the election, there was literally a note that said, don't forget to go vote on this proposition because it impacts the driver who's driving you right now. So, you know, I think that that was a lens into the capabilities of what these technology companies can do, not just from spending money perspective, but from mobilizing and utilizing their eyeballs and their technology.
Yeah, you know, there's an interesting sidebar to that too, which is the technology of social media allows anybody to basically say what arguments resonate best with what subgroups of people. And in that particular case in California, during this past election cycle in that proposition, what they found was that there was an argument to be made that if you were able to have more drivers out there as independent contractors, you would likely bring down the number of deaths from drunk driving. Hmm. And so they were able to reach out to Mothers Against Drunk Driving and turn them into an ally because they found that connection of what argument is going to resonate with what particular group. That's not something that used to happen in a scientific kind of a way in past election cycles. It might have been, you know, somebody might have thought about it as a lucky idea, but not using the technology to be able to forge these. And that's kind of, you know, the flip side of that is Cambridge Analytica.
Right.
So I wonder if now that this kind of thing has been weaponized, both Republicans and Democrats will continue to use it, whether Republicans will use it to find groups that will be more positively associated with them as opposed to associating on the QAnon negative stuff. What do you guys think about that?
Well, just to add to that, I think the challenge is that so few Republicans have come out in vocal and loud opposition to certain things that I think the vast majority of Americans would say are unacceptable. It makes it harder, I think, for particularly the technology platforms to even find an alternative voice. I was talking on a radio show about this recently, and you know, the example was Disneyland, which in California has been closed. Disney World in Florida has been open, and Disney hasn't really mobilized all of its eyeballs or its influence among the mass public in California to really do anything. And I said, well, what are they going to do? They're going to go to war with the Democratic Party in California that controls everything. And who do they turn to? A Republican? There's no Republican that they could really associate with their brand or that's credible enough to really carry a message or to change things for them. So, you know, I think the Republicans are at this weird inflection point where they're kind of sitting in the bathwater that they made for themselves, and then also starting to lose access to any kind of platforms that they would be able to use to mobilize their bases. And some of that's justified. Some of it's clearly not, because I don't think that tech should be the referee. Big tech should be the referee in terms of political discourse in our country. But I think that's unfortunately where they put themselves.
I just wonder ultimately whether or not the combination of racial insensitivity, a lack of a positive program, and then almost complete opposition from the tech oligarchy means that, you know, Marine Le Pen, this is where we're headed. Any last thoughts on that from the three of you?
Well, I think Brian makes a good point about Republicans not speaking out about a lot of these issues. And I think that's partially why the party is where it is today, because while it is a minority, a vocal minority that espouses these terrible ideas, the ones who should be speaking out about this, they feel that they can't. Especially, I mean, in you know, rightfully or wrongfully, they should have the backbone to still do it, even if they feel that they can't. But during this era, it was any time that you spoke out against the president or anything he said, you were then considered either, you know, a rhino or anti-Trump or whatever the case was, and you were kind of cast aside. And so a lot of them have come to just not speak out about anything. I mean, even going back over the summer when there were the, you know, well, when it turned into riots, they spoke out. But when it was just, you know, protest because of police brutality and things like that, they didn't speak out. They took that as an opportunity to sit silent because they felt that they would be attacked by fellow Republicans. So too often when these issues that would gain them support among the general public come up and boil up, they don't speak out against them. And I do think that combined with the silencing on social media and in the media in general, I mean, you know, to the point about banning, I think you were saying Facebook ads or something like that. After the election, Facebook did this wholesale ban of ads. And, you know, even for Urban Reformer, we try to run targeted Facebook ads. They say that you can't do it if it has anything to do with politics. But even if it's far removed from politics and you're just talking about something that happened in a city council meeting, they lump that in there. And so you can't run ads on that either. And that's, they extended that ban, I think, two or three times at this point post-election. So we're still in that ban. So with all of that happening and without an access to other groups that can elevate that message or without the ability to speak out, I do think that it kind of, you know, pushes the Republicans off to the side for the time being until they can figure something else out. You know, they tried alternative platforms that didn't really work out too well. So I'm not sure where they turn next.
Joel, could I suggest something on this as well? I think we need to reassert the principle that competition is a valuable phenomenon in our society. We need a competitive political environment with at least two parties that are both viable enough to hold the other in check, as it were, to always be providing a credible alternative. And we need competitive markets. We need policies that defend markets, not individual companies, you know, defend capitalism, but not individual capitalists. And I think we're very rapidly going to find that the idea of what are essentially, oligopoly or maybe duopoly players, for example, in social media, self-regulating is a totally non-viable way to proceed. We need to create a more competitive market for voices and media as well. I don't exactly know how to get there, but it ought to be a policy priority. I'd love to think about it with you in the future. Because I think that, I think actually that the leaders of the tech companies don't want to be the regulators either. I think they wouldn't mind a world without any regulation, but if there's going to be regulation, they kind of want it to come from Washington, because this is a totally non-viable. What we've just descended into cannot possibly last.
Well, maybe we should end up with Brian, since he's in the media wars directly. Any way of restoring sort of rational bipartisan debate that we used to have, or is that a lost cause?
I'm a natural optimist, so I think we most certainly can, and I believe that we will get there. I just think that we're in a turbulent period. I think that the first step, which if I'm assassinated later, you guys know why. The first step to doing that is for a bipartisan coalition in both the Senate and the House to start drafting regulations that would limit the influence of tech in terms of controlling information and speech. I think that with that, and this would be very unpopular with other publishers in the media, but I'm unapologetically who I am, that we also need to look at reforming our tort laws, and we need to think seriously and deeply about laws that punish people punitively for information that's inaccurate, potentially biased, or certainly disinformation, because as of now, there's not a whole lot of recourse for someone who is either silenced by a tech or media platform, or is inaccurately cast in a particular light. And I think that the media companies don't want that liability. The tech companies certainly don't want that liability. Me as an owner of several newspapers doesn't particularly love that liability. But in terms of the greater good, I think that's one of the only ways that you're going to put some teeth behind any type of legislation, because for legislation to work, there has to be consequences.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The Dominion voting machines case against Rudy Giuliani will be very interesting to follow in that regard, because it'll obviously, it's not just an issue of libel or slander between those two parties, but the enablement of that, if that in fact is proven to have taken place, the enablement of the media to make that happen is going to be, I think, potentially precedent setting. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with that. But gentlemen, thank you so much for being part of the Feudal Future podcast. We really appreciate it. Where the Republican Party goes from here is a matter of a great deal of speculation, and hopefully we can have you back again as life progresses.
Well, hopefully it progresses and not regresses.
Yeah, really, exactly. Or we may have a real feudal future in our future.
That's right.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.